Hello and welcome to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, Jess Wagg will be telling us a little bit about Bloom Syndrome. So what can you tell me about your experiences with Bloom Syndrome?
So obviously, myself, I have it. I was diagnosed when I was about 18 months old, and I've been affected in many ways. Me personally, I have quite a small stature. I've got a weak immune system, mainly with respiratory infections. And I've just had lots of different experiences in life. I've been treated differently. I've had struggles with my health, struggles socially. It's definitely been an experience, and I think as well, I've had a different experience because I was diagnosed quite young. I know there's a lot of people in the Blooms community that were misdiagnosed with other things prior, and then as they were older, they got diagnosed. So I was in a way quite lucky to know from very young that I had this. I think it's really kind of, as I've gotten older, I've really kind of decided that I've wanted to incorporate my life experience into my kind of career. So I'm just graduated a psychology degree at uni, and I've been doing volunteering work in kind of mental health and things like that. So I really want to support other people that have differences, no matter what they are. So obviously similar to me and the Blooms community.
So, when you were growing up, you mentioned you had some different experiences. How did you keep yourself strong in the hard times when someone misunderstood about your condition or you had to explain?
I think for me, I always chose wisely who I let into my life in terms of, and what they would know about me. Some people I had, growing up as friends, some didn't even know about my condition because I kind of knew that they wouldn't be able to handle it so well and maybe judge me more than others. So I was very, very kind of selective with who I let know that information, and I kind of allowed them to prove to me whether they would, they were a valuable friend or family member or, whoever really. I definitely had situations where people would ask me personal questions out of the blue and I was shocked. And sometimes I would respond well and I would educate them, and sometimes, it would get the better of me and I would just ignore them or walk away or say something, probably I shouldn't have said. I think always keeping a positive mindset is such an important thing, and being prepared for anything, for what anyone will say, is really good, because then if you are in a situation that's negative or someone says something or asks a question that's quite, shocking, you're always prepared and you always have an answer to give.
So I think that's interesting that you brought that up. Having to choose wisely, in so much as having that discussion later on in a relationship can make all the difference, because if you care about the person, you care about the person, and finding out one component of what makes them who they are shouldn't really reshape that perspective, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. I do think, unfortunately, that, people do judge, especially when it's something they don't know and it's not a common thing that they've heard of, and I think a lot of people just need to be educated on these things, and once they actually know, it's not that scary, and they just shouldn't really judge, because I think a lot of people have things that they just don't talk about.
So, in your time volunteering and giving back to the community, in terms of your own story, is there any success moment or story you've experienced you'd like to share?
In terms of, my success?
In terms of, things you've achieved and just making the community a better place by being part of it, essentially.
Yeah, so I think for me, recently I actually went and travelled to Sri Lanka for a month, and I volunteered in the hospital, psychiatric wards, and in a children's needs, special needs orphanage. And I would not have had that opportunity to kind of do that if it weren't obviously doing my degree, and that was a very big challenge for me. And I've obviously, you know, done that now, and I've graduated, and that was a long 4 years, but I got there in the end. I just really think that, you know, people with rare conditions or any kind of difference, you know, we really can do a lot, and we can actually sometimes do more than the, you know, someone who doesn't have, you know, a condition or anything like that, because we have the lived experience. I'm now applying for jobs, you know, as a peer support worker, so it's a job specifically based on you working with people with mental health issues and using your personal experience. So even though it seems like it's a negative thing and it's a hard situation, you know, having a rare condition and having all these struggles, it actually can really, really work in our favour, you know, and getting jobs. And I think it's just, you know, looking in the right places, and I think that's definitely a big success for me, is actually finding out that I can use my condition in a really, really good way.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
In this segment of our show, Laura Leach will be telling us a little bit about adaptive curling. So if you could introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about your work with adaptive curling, that'd be great.
So my name is Laura, and I'm the Director of Operations at Alderton Curling. So we run a variety of curling programs for all ages and abilities. So we have adaptive curling. We've had that there for several years now. We have folks curling in wheelchairs and motorized wheelchairs, which is pretty neat and I think fairly unique in curling. And we also have a youth para league, and we do have our Special Olympics curlers as well. So engaged with as many different groups in the community as we possibly can.
So how do you reach out to folks with disabilities to let them know the sport might be a good option for them?
That's a great question. It's a lot of word of mouth. Like I said, we've had adaptive curling ongoing for quite a while, so it's a lot of people kind of bringing their friends in and letting them know. We do try to engage with different community groups, so we started a youth curling league, and we did that with Thames Valley Children's Center. They were really helpful in inviting us to some of their try-it days, and then from that we thought, you know, we need to make a space for youth. Specifically to meet their sporting needs. So we created an adaptive youth league, and they've helped us promote it. We try to make sure it's really centered on our website so that people can sort of see that that's an option, and I think we have it on Parasport Ontario as well.
So what are some of the key benefits for an athlete being able to participate in curling?
I think, you know, curling is such a social sport, so there's a few things, right? There's that off-ice and that community piece that you get from any kind of team play, and the social element afterwards, you know, in every level of curling. After the game, it's really common to go up, you know, to the lounge and sit down with your opponents and just chat, right, whether it's about curling or not. So I think a really important part of what we provide is the social outlet. And then there's, you know, the physical activity of playing a sport, which is, you know, great physically. Certainly for curling, para curling, it's great for your shoulders, right? You're pushing basically 40 pounds of granite, about 140 feet down the sheet of ice. So I think that's great, and I think it's wonderful for people to just define themselves as maybe a curler, or however they want to see themselves in that space, and it's a real opportunity to do something different.
So what are some of the most common adaptations you make in terms of equipment or possibly even the rules, just to make sure everyone can have a shot at it?
Yeah, so there's throwing sticks for curling. So if you think of curling, if people are familiar with it, there's that sort of slide that looks like a lunge. But more and more we have throwing sticks, and that's, I mean, all kinds of curlers are using it, whether they're, you know, older adults or whether they have hip, back, knee problems, anything like that. It allows you to stand up, and it's similar to shuffleboard in that you have a stick that sort of reaches to the level of the rock, and you walk with it, and then you push it. And for folks in wheelchairs, what they do is they sit stationary with someone bracing their chair at the hob line, if you're familiar with curling, so the point by which you have to release the rock, and they push it. So the sticks for folks in chairs are much longer to give them a little bit more leverage, and there's also something to help them rotation on the rock. So we have that, and then for people in motorized chairs, what we do is we take the throwing stick and we attach it to their chairs. So the way they interact with this sport is they kind of start as far back as they can, and they get a whole bunch of speed, and then they stop, and the rock keeps going, and so they're able to participate that way. And I should have said earlier, we work with Participation House, a PHSS, and they come out and bring some of their community participants out and curl. So for those groups, or that group of fellas, they have a little bit less arm strength, but they sometimes are able to push the rock. So what we'll do with them is just shorten up the ice, right? So instead of trying to throw the full 140 feet, they can sort of, you know, sit wherever they are and push the rock, you know, a distance that's manageable for them. And that's something, curling is a very adaptive, easily adaptable sport. So it's sort of easy to change the distance from which you're throwing.
So in your time with the league, has there been any success moment or story you'd like to share?
Well, I think it's, you know, it's success on success, and it builds, which is so lovely. So like I said, we had adaptive curling at Ilderton for several years, long before I was involved with it. And we have some very competitive curlers, which is really neat to see. One of which is Mark Idison. So he is a multi Paralympian participant. He's received several medals, you know, so we're really proud of Mark, and to call Mark one of our own is really exciting thing for Ilderton curling. But we have a lot of competitive curlers, so seeing them go, you know, to different parts in the province to compete and play for provincial titles, or just even to get away and have that like fun weekend of competitive curling with people that are playing at their level, I think is great to see. We're excited to be hosting a Bonspiel, Para Bonspiel this year, and probably a provincial championship. So those are successes. And then opening it up, right, to start a para youth curling league, it's such a success. And I mean, numbers low, but hopefully that'll grow this year. And then the partnership with Participation House has just been so exciting to see. That develop, and you know, again, a different group of folks to come in and to curl, and you know, we all just love curling and want to get as many people as we can into the sport, and it lends itself so well to being adaptable that it's lovely to be able to, you know, bring people in. We have a great accessible building, and we have all the equipment, so it's nice to say just come as you are, we have everything you need to play this game. And it's lovely for our community, right? Our para curlers are some of the best curlers in our club. They're winning, you know, all kinds of different leagues. So I think that's really important for everybody, right? We all benefit from diversity, and it's lovely to have different members there.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
A young mother locking her car to keep the precious food inside out of reach. Stretching meals one more day. Over a million of us in Ontario depend on food banks, including more than 1,200 food banks and hunger relief organizations supported by Feed Ontario. Please, give now at feedontariotogether.ca for the big change your pocket change can make.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, Laura Leach told us a little bit about adaptive curling And we heard about Bloom Syndrome from Jess Wegg. In this segment of our show, Rachel Freeberg will be telling us a little bit about her work with pericarditis. So what can you tell me about your work with pericarditis?
I've been involved in it since 2020, almost since the beginning, but not fully involved. I was did some patient, sort of the patient, what would you call that? The committee, I guess, the patient committee. So I sort of interfaced with patients at the very beginning, and now since January, I came in as the president. I took over for Donna, who was the founder, Donna and Dr. Klein. So Donna's still on the board, and as is Dr. Klein, but I'm doing the president role now. So that's what I'm doing with the Alliance.
So for those who might not be as familiar with your work, work of the Alliance itself, tell me a little about it.
Sure. So the Pericarditis Alliance was formed about 5 years ago, or in 2020. And it's pericarditis is sort of a very old disease. It's been around for a long time. And then there's something called recurrent pericarditis that's a little more challenging and much more rare. So there's acute pericarditis. I'm not a medical provider, but there's acute pericarditis that lasts somewhere around 3 months, and it disrupts your life, but then you get back on track. But this recurrent aspect of it, I think it affects about 15% of the people who actually get pericarditis, so it's much more rare. It keeps going, and then it's hard to diagnose, and up until about a couple years ago, it was really hard to treat as well. And so the Alliance was formed as a patient advocacy organization to support patients, but also spread awareness about diagnosis and treatment to patients and the medical community. That's what we do.
So how do you reach out to the patient community to let them know that supports do exist for them?
Great question. There are, I guess, the way that we reach out is, and at this point right now, it's more people find us, since I think they'll probably Google pericarditis, and hopefully the Alliance comes up on the page, and then they can find us. There's other, since it's gotten a little bit more popular because of some new treatments, there are other ways on the internet to kind of come to the Alliance. So then people will reach out to us if they're looking for community, because it's very isolating to have this illness. It's usually almost everybody who has this is at one point or another is told by the doctor that, oh, that you don't have pericarditis anymore, you just have anxiety, you're GERD. It becomes isolating because you really can't find anyone else who's had this, and even you can't even find a doctor who's able to identify that you have it. So when they find us online, they're wanting to have some community and support, and I think they find it really, really relieving and welcoming to find that they're not the only ones with this experience and that they're not crazy.
So do you have any advice for someone who's just starting on their pericarditis journey, just steps they can take to better educate themselves and to find that community support?
Sure. When you are first starting on pericarditis journey, if it actually is turning out to be that it's recurrent and it's coming back, it's a shock. This often happens to people who are in the prime of their life, going along, very, very healthy people, and then all of a sudden everything that you're used to doing, you're prevented from doing because you have to keep your heart rate below 100, because that helps you heal. helps the pericardium heal. So the advice is that, like, this is a huge shock. This is a huge change to the way your life is and how you were and how you identified. And it won't always be this bad. Things are going to be all right, but they might just be a little bit different. So sort of from an emotional standpoint, that's what advice I would give. Other than, in addition to that, I would say read the journal articles. We have them on our website, and there's some new guidelines coming out soon from Europe. Those are great guidelines. They're going to be on our website once they come out, probably in the fall. But read some journal articles, get an idea of how the experts diagnose and manage this. And then when you go to see your doctor, really pay attention to their alignment with the information that you've learned from all of your reading. And if you don't feel like they are up to speed on this information, it's okay. Go find somebody else who is. And these doctors, some very, very good cardiologists, are just sometimes not as informed about this. And that's a very big reason why we're here. And hopefully we'll, you know, be building that awareness, for the medical community. But if it's not a bad thing that they don't know, it's just that sometimes people don't know what they don't know. But since you're getting all this good information from the journal articles, you're going to have an idea of what your doctor is familiar with. And if they aren't, then keep looking for one. And if you need to go and travel for care and it's within your resources, you're worth it. It's a very weird decision to make, especially if you're a healthy person, to decide that you need to go to a center of excellence and travel across the country make that kind of a financial and time commitment. You are actually worth that. This is an illness that actually needs that kind of attention. It's not just a minimal thing. This is a very life-altering illness. So I think that's about a lot of the stuff I would tell somebody.
Like, thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Thanks.
Sure.
Adaptive curling, my friends, like any other disability sport, must require a tremendous amount of strength and determination on the part of the athlete. Fact is, disability sports sometimes get overlooked in the shuffle and the glitz and the glamour of their mainstream equivalents. However, these athletes train all their lives and show dedication and commitment to their games. They put on a great show, and honestly, it should be a matter of just enjoying the exhilaration watching these great athletes being out there and giving it their all, whether they have a disability or not. And honestly, I love the sports that bring together athletes with disabilities and those without, because this creates a bridge of commonality, of understanding, the recognition that someone's disability does not have to be an all-defining factor. And the thing I love about disability sport is, in a lot of cases, with an acquired injury or chronic illness, you can give someone that focus, that anchor to life that they so need at the beginning. In the early stages of recovery, especially from an acquired injury, there can be this shock, this questioning of, can I still lead a full, rich life? And I've seen time and again disability sport answering that question, not as the end-all, be-all of what this person is necessarily going to do with their life, but as something that can help them find purpose, community, and strength that translates on and off the court. Someone who's made an athletic or a healthy lifestyle their main focus in the world, there can be this question of, can I still be at my best? Can I still achieve great things? It's up to each of us to answer that question, however. You can't go in expecting to be the person that you always were up until that moment changed you. But you can ask the question of, how can I adapt this to my new situation? How can I gear myself up to still get out there, enjoy myself, put on a great show for the audience, should there be one? And how can I get into community? How can I learn from others who have been down this road? And these are the questions a person must ask. Accepting your new normal doesn't mean that you're living a limited or glass ceiling type of life. It simply means embracing the opportunity to find a new source of strength, find a new innovation, if you will. And that's what disability life is. It's all about looking beyond the obvious, looking beyond the surface, asking those questions of, I can't do it this way, but can I do it that way? Try it. If it works, great. If it doesn't, try some other way. The real tragedy in life is essentially the disability self-fulfilling prophecy. When someone comes along with a closed mind and says, this is all you are, this is all you can be, chances are the information is coming from an outdated textbook, third-hand information, or just not knowing the strength of the person. Someone with a disability can and will surprise you every time if given the right tools, the right moments, the right opportunities. But if they choose to accept someone else's viewpoint that says that you are not capable of this, that, or the other, it can become cemented in stone. And that's a tragedy. A loss of not only their own exploration, their own growth, but a loss to the community from one who's hesitant to try because they've been told nothing but they have nothing to contribute. It's up to each of us to ask the question, is this the all-defining authority? Have I tried it for myself? Is there even the slightest possibility there might be more to my story than meets the eye? If a person chooses to take it with a grain of salt, no matter how trusted the source, they may find that they're driven, that they're pushed to explore their own capabilities. And it's not just a matter in sport. It comes across relationships, academic life, professional life. If you choose simply to be given a pat on the head and a fistful of empty promises, chances are you'll never explore your own potential. But if you ask, is this really something I can try, and then go out and take a step, you might find it's something you love, you might find it's something you hate, but you'll definitely find it was something worth exploring. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you we're all equal. So get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, August 22nd, 2025. I'm Brianne Doyle.